I had the pleasure of working with a lot of leaders across the industry, and I would have to say that Michael, I think, is an exceptionally astute business person and has his head in where the market is at and where the future is potentially for the industry, both in architecture and design and the Queensland market. Let's jump on in. Hi, Michael. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast, and we really enjoy having you on. Michael, would you like to introduce yourself and a little bit about Open Architecture Studio?
Hi, Seaton. Thanks for having me. It's really great to catch up with you today. And so about myself, I'm an architect, a business owner, an entrepreneur, I suppose. And the team that I lead now, it's almost a team of 20. We're based here in Brisbane, Queensland, and also have a small and growing team in the Philippines as well that support the work that we do here in Australia.
And they're fully integrated into your team. It's not like how some people are using it as an outsource. They're in your teams, you have meetings, you go over. It's very much an international team as well.
Yeah, that's right. And I guess that's a decision we took really early on when we were looking at that option. We did investigate the typical kind of business process outsourcing, did actually look at getting a team on from a different country, and that didn't quite work. I think the communication was challenging. And so taking this approach where we actually have an office space that we use and rent out over there, I go over and I recruit there so that they've all met me. We get them here as well. Construction processes and methodologies are just so different that actually bringing them here makes them not only feel like they're a part of the team, but get to understand how things are delivered on the ground here in Australia. So I think it's a really important component that there's actually a two-way exchange as well. So our team has to learn to communicate really, really clearly, and their team has to learn kind of some of the Australian lingo and the ways of constructing, and also just the cultures. Understanding and reflecting on our own culture and learning others as well is probably an important part of that.
Absolutely. And I think it's one of the things that we're definitely going to cover off today is the challenges and how things look ahead. I think you're one of the few firms who are doing it quite well. I know a lot of other firms are using BPO or outsourcing, and it's how you make that work and what that is. And I think in an industry where the fees are just continuing to go down, it's a smart way of being able to do it. But it is about people learning how to work differently. And it's quite funny because a lot of design firms are very much, we need somebody here, they have to be in the office. And it's funny how that translation within skills goes across. And I mean, having worked in remote first offices or running that, it is a different way of operating. So we'll talk about some of those challenges and things like that. So tell us a little bit about Open Architecture and who you help and what types of projects that you work on.
Yeah, so we typically focus on community and social infrastructure. So we have built a reputation, I suppose, in the school space. There's education is a big pillar of what we do. Tourism as well, so hotels and resorts.
Yeah, right.
And in that tourism bucket, we talk about arts and culture. So tourism we see as really an experience, and it's local experience first. And then that extends to the visitor economy as well. So that's that tourism bucket. And then our sports is another big pillar and component of what we do. So, you know, everything from local clubs all the way up to really elite performance, high performance centres that we're working on now. So, and it's really interesting, I suppose, one of the things that I've come to realize over the years is that actually everything that I'm interested in, my passions, learning and growth, is the education piece, the sport, staying healthy and active, and the tourism, traveling and experiencing the art and culture is really my passions. And I suppose being able to build a business around that. And I think the interesting thing is that actually it's because clients respond to that passion when you talk about it, not only with knowledge and enthusiasm, but with passion. And then you can bring team along on that journey as well. So everybody that we've recruited and grown our team with understands that these are the things we do and that resonates with them. And so we're able to, I guess, niche ourselves in an area where people actually enjoy this stuff. It's not just a job to them. is actually part of their lives and their passion as well. So I think it makes life richer when you're able to do things that you enjoy and love.
Well, I mean, I think that's it, because if you're the person who's also the end user in that case, you're thinking about it from the experience that people are going through in that too. And as you said, you can never replace passion. And I think in design, that is what I remember. This is something early on, is people buy your passion as well. They buy your understanding, your ability to empathize and put yourself in that position and look at things from different, plus collecting, obviously, stakeholders and understanding what might be important for them, drawing that out of them to be able to come up with the best design outcome as well for them. So very interesting. Now, obviously, there's lots of things going on. You're currently based in Queensland, and obviously, you know, the Queensland market is an interesting market at the moment. There's lots going on. There's obviously lots of competition of having things built. The cost has gone through the roof versus, I suppose, Queensland hasn't quite used to the growth rate of construction costs, and that's only going to continue. Do you want to talk about a few of the challenges, and then we're obviously going to talk about the amazing opportunities that are in the market too, but what you're seeing at the moment within Queensland, probably describe what that's looked like over the last sort of few years and how it's progressed.
A lot of the work we do in clients, we have they fall into two buckets, I suppose. One is that government client, typically local council and state government. And then your private developers, and those private developers, I guess, have just come out of COVID, typically in the tourism space or mixed-use retail space, which has changed quite significantly over the years. That mixed-use retail is probably an area that I didn't talk about, but again, it's a big community centre, that the type of work that we like to do. So retail has shifted over the years. COVID really meant that a lot of those tourism operators took a big hammering and have had to rethink their ways of operating and have had to deliver more robust and well-rounded offerings that perhaps somewhat immune, not necessarily completely, but they're certainly looking to diversify their offerings. They're looking to make sure that it's multi-age group as well in that tourism space. So it's, you know, they're not just kind of, you know, pubs are not catering to your stereotypical middle-aged bloke who's spending a bit of money on the pokies and buying 20 beers. They're now actually catering to families with kids. They're catering to the older generation who still like that lifestyle and the ability to make friends and family, people with dogs. You know, they're really starting to open up and see the broader market that is available to them and relying on that. So there's, you know, a focus on driving revenue in terms of the, you know, pure residential stuff, which we don't do a lot of, but we're seeing construction prices, as you said, have risen quite substantially, but sale prices are now catching up to that really quickly in the multi-res space. And I think news out the other day said that Brisbane is set to overtake Sydney in terms of sale price for apartments, which is a really wild statistic.
Wow.
When you look at the graph, it's literally just skyrocketed in the last 4 years. And that's driven by the cost of construction. So it makes sense that, you know, new stuff is selling for what new stuff needs to sell for, and everything else is catching up because the demand is definitely there. So overall, there's certainly demand in the economy. Things are alive and kicking. There's people moving here. I think you've started to see a slight change in migration where people have come up here because houses were cheaper and rents were cheaper and there were jobs available. And now I think that the ebb happened and now the flow back is starting to happen a little bit. But I think with the Olympics on the horizon and lots of big infrastructure projects, there will continue to be strong demand, not only for, you know, that social tourism experience, but also just for simple everyday conveniences in the retail space and the living space. So certainly the demand is there, and some of it just has to be delivered, and that's the cost that is going to be delivered. But developers are making really strategic decisions about what they do to make sure they reinforce their revenue and limit their cost expenditure.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think Queensland market's a very different market than you might see in the Melbourne and Sydney market. And it's quite interesting. I think about a conversation a mate and I had before we moved up. So it must have been like 21, 22. It was kind of post-COVID. They'd moved through. And they're like, yeah, we expect the property prices in Queensland will go up. This is all, you know, people are going to see all this. All the Olympics are going to happen. I sat there at the time going, no. That's like, it's never going to, the house price is never going to be more than house price in Melbourne. Biggest regret ever. Totally missed the market completely. And, you know, our house in Melbourne is worth less than our house in Queensland now. And what that might be on a domestic side, but obviously what that's looking at is in, you know, there's also a developer saying can't make these things stack up because of construction cost. But as you said, now on the residential side, it's changing. I think the other thing that I notice in the market too is a confidence. I think, you know, we can talk about what Victoria and Sydney is also, there's still a lot of confidence there. It's probably a bit like a seesaw. I feel like, you know, Brisbane's on the up, Melbourne's on the down, and Sydney's sort of like wavering in the middle. There's still lots of things going on. But, I mean, we're talking about an East Coast economy that used to be Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane. And now that gap's really changed. And you see a lot of people trying to enter into the market, into Queensland. Mm. And I identify that it operates very differently to the markets in Sydney and in Melbourne. So, you know, for example, here there's a lot more DNC, there's a lot more ECIs, excuse me if I don't get all the terminology, there's a lot more involvement with the builders and the cost of what actually needs to be. But there isn't as many builders up here too, you know, and obviously changing governments had a massive change, I think, as well, and I'd love to hear what your opinions on that. But obviously, you know, we've now got a government that's trying to move development through, trying to obviously control, get a few more controls on trade unions, on the effects on that, on larger, you know, tier one size. But we still have a lot of builders that went out of the market, and we still have a lot of lack of trades as well.
Yeah, you're right. The Brisbane market is very different, and even, you know, shifting out of that pure construction and delivery piece into the design piece, it feels like people in and developers in Melbourne, Sydney are perhaps more focused on quality and well-versed in design. I probably get shot down by a few of my own clients here in Brisbane for saying that. But there's certainly...
Well, that's what I was subtly trying to say. Like, design is like what you do. It's a real part here, whereas it seems to be the cost and then the design fits into that. And that is where there's a slight difference in maturity, I find, in the Melbourne and Sydney design market is versus the Queensland market.
I think, though, the one thing that does encourage me about Queensland and your question about the government at the moment is that there's a real sense of let's get on and do things here in Queensland. Not only is the urgency of the upcoming Olympics driving that, but I think that's founded and rooted in a lot of the history of this state, where there's a lot of developers who've got a lot of guts and a lot of get up and go and a lot of Queensland kind of let's just make some really great decisions and pivot and change as we need to, but we're going to get on and do it. And I think without that, the state wouldn't be as successful as it is. And I think that's reflected in many aspects of our economy. So, you know, I think the two, perhaps when you don't sit around and deliberate about quality as much, it means that you can get on and do things. And I think that's a really important part as well, because, you know, architects are often at the mercy of decisions that are not in our hands. And if we end up holding up things based on a design quality thing, sometimes that project doesn't happen at all. And I'd rather see projects happen and things keep moving than them get entirely stuck and solutions not delivered to the market for this growing economy that we need. Yeah. So it's a bit of a balance. And listen, we love to see great design embedded into everything, and we'll do that overtly and subtly and try to help our clients out with surprising things, which we love it when they say to us, I really didn't understand this in the design, but now that it's built, it's really wonderful. Thank you for never talking to us about that, but just making sure that you looked after it. So, you know, and it's never done, I suppose, underhandedly or with bad intention, but it's always done with a good intention for the benefit of the project. So
yeah.
We do try to focus on those things and just get a bunch of the really fundamental things right, but still make sure the projects keep moving.
Well, I think that's obviously, I think, the big conversation really around the end of the day, you've got to get projects built, you know, and what the definition of good design is as well. So that's a whole other topic we could go into. I suppose, you know, obviously with lots of things going on in the economy and, you know, there's, you're obviously more on the social side and I think it's great because you're impacting people where they learn, where they go to, you know, really relax or to have their entertainment, connect with people, and which I think is obviously the hospitality side is a big part, you know, especially in Queensland. We spend a lot of time outside. It is a really social culture as well, you know, and people have the ability generally, you know, you go on a Friday afternoon, most people are off camping most of the time and enjoying the environment. It's then how they're connecting with people in the built form on the weekends as well is another thing. It's a very, very interesting time for obviously the economy as well. You know, we're recording this in early May and obviously there's been a few things going on in the global politics, and that's having obviously economic effects. We've got some of the highest inflation rates that we've ever had in the last few years, and obviously the interest rates are the Reserve Bank's only way of trying to control that. So we're probably in for further hikes within that. What do you see as some of the other challenges or the challenges that you see at this point in time, the next 12 months and sort of the next 5 years as well?
Certainly our clients are starting to talk to us already about slowing revenue, particularly in that F&B hospitality experience and tourism space. They seem to have weathered it reasonably well. You know, there was that big oil price shock that I think meant everybody pulled up stumps for a couple of weeks while they worked out what was going on. And I think that really the full effects of that probably haven't quite been seen or felt or understood, just how bad that is and how well insulated Australia is from that, I'm not entirely sure. I think what will happen, and you'll start to see this, is that that delayed inflation where it was on everybody's lips and on everybody's minds, but nobody really understood it. And it was kind of like 12 months or 18 months, or even 2 years down the track where people started to say, oh, like, the price of a bag of chips is now doubled. And, you know, people, I think, really understand it at that level. And that's when they start to change their spending habits in that experience space. The builders, I think a lot of builders are wise to those sort of inflation shocks now after, you know, decades of prices creeping up very gradually or even potentially in some sectors going down. I think they now have contracts that are sensitive to those price increases, and ultimately in that public sector it's going to be the government that has to foot the bill for those. So, you know, schools and sporting facilities will no doubt go up in price, the cost of haulage and all that. But I think the builders, you know, we saw a big collapse in the market across Australia of builders going under because they had signed up to these contracts that didn't allow for that inflation. I think a lot of builders are better placed now because they've weathered that storm and they're now wise to how to manage it. And so the risk, I think, is now going to fall on those clients, which ultimately is the government. They're putting a lot of pressure, state government at the moment, on the costs of all of their projects. There's a lot of scrutiny on that because they know that they've got promise to uphold with their electorate.
Yeah, absolutely.
That they need to deliver, they need to show that they've delivered, you know, need to put a big number up on screen saying we've delivered 1,000 homes or whatever the number is, and that we've delivered 30 schools. And for every school or house that doesn't get delivered, that number goes down. And that for every one of those that, where the price goes up, you've got to make sacrifices elsewhere. And the other thing I think comes into play is the Queensland's government's credit rating, and I know that that's under pressure and that will only increase their borrowing costs and reduce their, you know, their ability to spend. So it's a really tricky thing that I think the government's trying to manage. In terms of the private sector, we're seeing a lot of those clients continue to be really discerning about where they spend their money. There's We're not involved in the high-end resi space, but I think that will continue to grow and people will continue to deliver work there. That mid-range apartment space, I think, will continue to suffer. Things like the retail space and the F&B, I think we're starting to see clients be really selective about what they spend on, and they're making sure that they're getting a return on that revenue for the spend that they're making. And some of them are nervous. Others have sort of already committed capital budgets, and that might mean that when it comes to it, they need to make value management decisions on the ground with builders, which certainly here we're not, we're pretty used to that. Being able to juggle things around.
And I think that's the hard thing, isn't it? You know, you're designing depending on the size of the project, but it may not be built depending on what phases it's at. Once you're getting through, it might be 6 or 12 months, and, you know, those things are changing quite rapidly at the moment as well. All right, well, let's take a bit of a transition and talk a bit about the longer term. Now, you're quite tech-savvy. You're quite onto it. I think I would say out of all of the architectural leaders I've met, you're probably the one who's thinking about the future and quite got their finger on the pulse and experimenting a lot with things. You know, you've got a decent sized firm, but also not that large that you're still in control and being able to sort of look at where it looks. Obviously, we've talked about, you know, your team being over in the Philippines, and I think a lot more firms are starting to outsource the documentation side of things. You know, AI is a big one, and at the moment, obviously, it can make a lot of improvements on the operational side of things. But what I'm quite interested in is where you sort of think architecture will be in the next 5 years. And I will say normally you'd say 10 years, but I reckon 5 years that's the pace. It could even be 12 months, to be honest with you. But we're moving at an exponential, or 10 times in the logarithm. I'm not quite sure of the correct term. It's changing faster than we've ever seen it before. And what do you think it'll look like, let's say, by 2030?
I think it'll look quite different. I'm chuckling away, I guess, because I suppose, you know, the last couple of years I've had a really purposeful approach to trying to understand AI and what that means for us as a business. And no sooner do I think I've put my finger on a small piece of it than something new comes along that I don't quite understand. And I've then got to sort of go, all right, I maybe only just understand this. Let's move on and understand the next thing. It really moves so quickly. And I think some of our more savvy clients are already starting to replace some of the work we're doing in the early stages. So I wouldn't be surprised if there's clients out there, and I've been quizzed about this by them, wouldn't be surprised if there's clients who are talking to their favorite chat app. Probably Gemini, and producing early concepts for projects. Now, you know, to win a tender on a site that they might be putting in a proposal for that relies on, you know, a quality of proposal, not only the dollar amount that they're putting on that site, or even just to generate some early ideas. We know that the briefs we receive from them are definitely AI generated. I think that's the easy piece. We know that in the government sector, they're evaluating our tenders with AI and comparing them that way. I'm pretty sure that that's happening. But certainly, you know, the work that we do, because it's becoming easy in some aspects to produce early concepts, is certainly being eroded. And I think the very technical part of what we do, plus a really nuanced understanding about how to discern and differentiate between potentially two schemes, both produced by AI, and to look at them and say, well, actually, this one is better but needs these adjustments than this one because of these reasons, I think we'll still sit with the architect. And certainly as you move into more detailed design, terms of generating actual methods of construction and ways to put things together and to document those and convey those, I think it'll get easier for us, but I think there will still be a role for us to play, but it's certainly diminishing. The you know, we've had clients maybe a decade ago who would say to us, oh, can you send us the Revit model? We'd like to open it and have a look. And, you know, that level of capacity and ability is only increasing.
Mm.
And because it's getting easier and easier to do that, there's certainly all around the edges of what we do is being diminished. But it's also, I think, in that there's opportunities for us to do things better and to have things supported by that process. So what architecture looks like in, you know, less than a decade, 20, 30, 4 years away, around the edges, I think it will have changed. At its core, it'll probably still be very much the same in that clients are looking for a trusted advisor to guide them and help them deliver on their project. They realize that they can't do that alone. And so they reach out to people like us to help them on that journey. And I think the real test of how businesses survive will be the quality of that relationship and the level of trust that we're able to establish and the level of value that we're able to continue to deliver. And so architects, I think, originally were sort of the original project managers in the construction space, and now that's been carved off as a separate thing. I think that might actually start to come back towards architects, and those two fields having been quite distinct, I think will come back together a little bit closer, where those project managers will probably have more of a design involvement because they're able to, or they're able to push us in smarter ways, because they might just say to the chat, please evaluate this, and it comes back with a whole bunch of design decisions or suggestions, and they pass that on and they say, this is what my chat says. It sounds right to me. And vice versa, we'll be saying to them, hey, you know, my chat has reminded me that you haven't followed up on XYZ. And so those two fields, I think, having been a little bit separate, will start to come back together, because it's easy for both of us to do that, or easier for both of us to do that job.
Well, and I think holding the, I mean,
sorry, holding the hand of the client through there will be a really important piece as well.
And I think that's where there's a few things you've touched on. There's obviously the operational part, but there's the automation side outside of, if we put AI and automation in one bucket, they're obviously different things, but the AI can be used to automate a lot more processes. I think it'll be really interesting how much time, even for project managers, that will, because you can see them being able to save a lot more time, being able to put a lot more documents together a lot quicker. But at the same time, it's not going to take away from managing the to and fro and doing this, right? But it is good at potentially being able to build out the right systems to be able to remind, this is going on, we need to keep this. And which are already done through SaaS systems. And that's why I think the interesting thing is, I really wonder how much AI is replacing SaaS. It's doing different things, right? And it can build it itself. Mm. How that's going to now sort of change in a way. I mean, we know that a lot of this is also going to be reducing a lot of things that are repetitive or can have an analysis. I'm interested to see how that's going to continue for the engineering space too over the next bit. But the fundamentals of having somebody who knows what they're talking about, knowing how it's going together, understanding the human aspect. And I think that's the one thing with AI is that you can, as somebody else said, it is like the 10th or the 11th architect. Everybody would come up with a different version. But again, it's the information of where it's being directed, of where it will go. And that's, I think, as a species also, we are learning how this thing works and how we actually utilize it and what different outcomes we can get from what different variables are put in. And so it'll be interesting how that evolves. Probably I look at the architecture space, and when you talk about the feasibilities, right, that was generally done for a very low cost for how much time it is. It's kind of that loss leader that's generally done for firms to do it, to get in, to build the relationship, and then hopefully if it progresses, then that comes back in a return later. Mm. It's interesting what you're saying about the feasos, because I know a friend even who's very AI savvy, and, you know, they work for a school, and they just did up a quick visualization of something just in the early stages. They were talking about, oh, we might want to do this. And they're like, okay, you probably build this much. Here's the, you know, put the side in. And the architect's like, how did you do that? And he's like, just AI, mate. So, you know, that's not replacing what the architect does, but it's an example of it's interesting how you're observing the same thing too, that people are starting to potentially, how can we utilize this to just do some quick feasibilities? Because there is a bit of formulas in that. The design ethos is different, but the formula in how much space can we actually take up, how much can we fill, it can be a bit of a formula in itself. Yes. If we're talking about, you know, multi-res or, you know, commercial big buildings where you're trying to work out the feasibility, it will be interesting how that potentially connects in the future then to the QSs and the cost estimates to actually see. So I think that's going to be very interesting where things continue. Probably for the architects, one of the things that I say is the documentation side. So that's obviously where most of the fee lies and most of the manual work comes in. You know, do you think that's going to fundamentally change? Because I see there's lots of potential there. At the end of the day, if AI is good with rules and formulas, if you put codes in and standard ways of doing things, could that potentially be, you know, that is going to be reliant on the software you're using. So obviously Autodesk and Revit, or, you know, people are still using ArchiCAD, what that potentially progresses.
Yeah, listen, you can see the start of it now, and some things are easier than others. I'd like to think there's still always going to be a role for architects. I imagine that this will get replayed in 10 years' time, and people will laugh, and they'll go, how naive were we? And look how incredible these systems are. So I'm sure there will be plenty of areas that are replaced and automated and supplemented. But again, when you're on site, for example, and you've got a wall and you're trying to work out where the column should go and how to make the joint waterproof and watertight and structurally sound, those kinds of decisions, which are actually really complex and require, you know, a three-dimensional understanding plus a contextual understanding of the situation plus a sort of intellectual understanding of the solutions and the problems, are so multifaceted and layered that I think it'll be a long time, and I don't think it's impossible, but it'll be a long time before those sorts of challenges can be resolved. There's also really, you know, just in terms of the production of work that we do, there's some really technical things that in the way things are put together. You know, well, I suppose talking about just moving slightly aside from the actual documentation, but in terms of the stuff that we're using to supplement our business processes, like you said earlier, we're talking to Claude. We're producing systems that are automating a lot of what we're doing. And we can see that, you know, for example, we've got a learning management system up now that connects with our task management system, which connects with all of our quality assurance and all that sort of thing. Those were all sitting in independent systems floating around the place. Now they're all tied together. And when we spot a challenge with somebody saying, I can't, when I press this button, it should take me here, but it doesn't, it takes us 5 minutes to go in and fix that code and say, wow, this is what we want, simply by talking to it. So when I look at the ability to implement change in how we do our work in that sphere, and I translate that to the technical side, theoretically, you know, it's an endless kind of opportunity to replace a lot of what we do, and really for us to, again, there be there as a guide, like we are with the chat, to guide the coding along and say, well, this is what we want and this is how we want it to work. I'm sure the architecture will be a little bit like that. At the moment, there's a new piece of software out there that can check your quality control, and you can upload two documents and say, this is our reference document and this is the newly produced document. Please confirm that the newly produced document adheres to all the standards that have been set up in our reference document, but also our standards document. And it's sort of been trained to understand all the little symbols and can come back and say, oh, you haven't dimensioned these six things, and then you've got set down symbols here. It takes over 24 hours to run a single A1 page through that system for it to get checked, right? So you can, you sort of dial that back and you say, AI can answer me really quickly on simple things, it must be thinking really hard across a lot of vectors and data sets to try and understand that. So I think, you know, we're going to have to improve how we manage that data to really see discernible changes. You know, a QA check on the similar sort of drawing by a human is not going to take you 24 hours now.
No.
It's going to be much quicker. So the efficiencies are not quite there, but they're coming. They are sure as hell coming.
Yeah. So, well, I mean, the thing is, though, we just worry about all the data centers and the energy production that we need to be, you know, using. You think about how much data that's taking for that 24 hours, as you say, it's in learning and then going. But it's very interesting. It's essentially, the more that we put in and challenge, the more that this can do. But what you are saying is that it is just going to be, you know, from the actual professional side of things, it's just minimizing things that were taking lots of time. Right, you know,
that's right,
and automating, potentially being able to look at that, tell it a process that would be, do, you know, you have to train it and you have to still set all of that up. So all the stuff that you've set up, you know, everybody can kind of customize to a point, but then there's also parts of understanding the nuances of what needs to be checked and what needs to be set up and where does that work. For me, when I look at this within your business, is it just makes you highly efficient, right? So it essentially means you've got the ability to potentially deliver at a higher rate and deliver a better outcome and be in a better competitive point than a lot of your competitors who may not have quite applied themselves in the same way to wanting to understand and to do that. And that's why I think it's interesting, because yes, you own a studio, but yes, I would say you have more of an entrepreneurial head into sort of seeing how things are operating, where things are going, and exploring what can we utilize. At the end of the day, it's still the built form and architecture which you're delivering, but the approach to approaching in different ways. And I think that I think, as you mentioned, a lot of people might be also automating. I also will find it interesting how the fees will potentially diminish again as well. So I think it's an interesting part that you mentioned of, you know, at the end of the day, we had this on earlier podcasts, you know, the architect used to be like the master builder. How are things built? How do we put it together? In Australia, it's interesting how it's the role of the architect is slowly diminished bit by bit. And I think that's a bit about risk adversity and architects wanting to take on those risks. Or maybe it's the great design minds that maybe not as, you know, like the project managers, as pragmatic and keep things moving, and that type of brain, which we do have people in the architecture world who do that too, but most people join it because of the creative side of their brain versus the systematic side, which is very important as well. So I think it'll just be interesting. Yes, these are tools at the end of the day. I said on an earlier podcast that I thought about it the other day when I was interviewing somebody, you know, who was starting their career in the 90s, and we're talking about and starting on, you know, drawing boards, and then obviously we see CAD come in, and then we see 3D come in, and, you know, that's mainly Revit these days for large firms. And you think about that, that's actually not that long ago. We're not talking very long. So this will just be another tool, and how it integrates. And when I say this, it's nuances of how is it applied by different aspects of what people are using or new tools that might come up. But essentially the role of the architect hasn't fundamentally still changed, and that's what you're describing as well.
That's right. And I think when you look back at those images of architectural firms from the 70s, they had these enormous halls with rows and rows of drawing desks, all with men in white suits and a tie, kind of hunched over these drawing boards. They were probably working on, you know, there might have been 100 of them. They were probably delivering as much work as we can deliver as a 20-person office. And so, you know, architecture is no, I guess we've been really accustomed to being at the pointy end of this technological change. For one reason or another, it's just been a really great place for digital technologies to embed itself and to grow and assist us in what we're doing. And so, you know, I look forward to, you know, an architectural practice of 20 or 30 being the equivalent of a 100 person practice from only a decade ago. So I think that will be one of the changes, is the volume that we can deliver. And yes, there will be pressure on our fees for sure. But I think along with that comes the ability to deliver more. And I suppose one of the risks that you run into is that you can run too fast and try to do too much too quickly and miss some of the really important things along the way. So, I think there's challenges, but lots of opportunities ahead.
What do you see as some of those still really important things, sort of fundamental, like both as somebody who runs a studio, but also for those who are entering the profession? And, you know, these tools might help them in lots of ways, but the fundamentals I don't think are going to necessarily change.
The first thing that comes to mind is relationships with people and how you interact. And I'll give you a really great example. We've implemented with this AI system, we're building a candidate hiring process, which I heard the other day that came up, Woolies, you are interviewed on video by AI and that all gets assessed. We're not quite at that level. We've got a little bit more of a human process, but some of the assessment of those candidates' responses is supplemented with AI. And so we're able to get and identify really great candidates that have a great fit with our culture. And that might not mean that somebody who doesn't rank highly on our assessment doesn't have a great fit somewhere else. What we're finding is people that like to work on the things we're working on in the way that we work. And like every relationship, those fundamental cultural pieces are really important. Those, I think, will continue through all of this. And the ability to have that connection not only with each other as we collaborate and deliver things, but also with our clients in the marketplace and also with our external consultants. And if you deliver great work but you're offensive, I don't think you're going to build a great reputation in a business. And so you might have AI delivering the greatest work, but if you're offensive in the way that you do it, I don't think you're going to continue to do work for people. So there's a really, really interesting balance there of that really human touch that I think is going to be important. The relationships and the way that we do things, the way that we treat each other will be more important than ever. But I think also there's this, it's like the sixth sense that some architects and clients in the built environment space have for things that are going to work and things that are not going to work. And sometimes it's hard to put a finger on it and say, this is the magic that you've created and this is why. Sometimes designers just have it or you don't have it. And I think the ones that have it will continue to flourish and they'll be supported by the AI and will deliver even more exciting spaces if they're not value managed out.
Oh, well, I don't think the profession is going anywhere. I think the way that it necessarily applies and what size and studios, as you said, the what was done by 100 people can be now done by 20 people. And I think that this is a really exciting time for boutique firms to actually be able to potentially, and there are multiple firms out there, right? There may not be in architecture, there may be in design, who can come up a bit against the big guys. And it's because they know who they're doing, who they are, and they've got their processes so down pat. They can still deliver tier one size projects and still have that caliber without having to be that mass size. And I think it's interesting. I mean, about 75 to 83% of Ventipin Switch market, most firms are still under 10, right? But then it's like who's sitting in that middle part? Who's sitting in that large part? And again, as you mentioned, it is all about trust and understanding. And that comes down to relationships. And it isn't relationships in a nepotism type of way. It's actually about understanding people and understanding what's the outcome we're really trying to come out with here. The design is one part, but it's actually who are we building this for? What is the outcome that we're looking for? And I think it's that inherent part to be able to, you know, this was something I heard from an earlier podcast, be able to ask those questions, to draw that information out of people, to inherently understand that. And I think that human side isn't necessarily going anywhere. The tools that we may use to produce things may change, but that element doesn't necessarily, you know, it's the same thing in an organization. People want to go to work and like the people they work with. You know, it's a similar part. We work in a similar way. It all operates. We need diversity in our thought. And cognitive diversity was a great thing we had previously. We need that diversity, but we also need to have that tribe where we also do want to get along. We're quite clear in the way that we behave and who we are. I think when we bring this back also to the Queensland market, I think what's really interesting is the Queensland market is still very relationship driven. And as you said, I find it a quite, in some ways, as you said, there's just this kind of get on with it attitude. I don't think there's as much of the, I think it's just, there's less, probably maybe a bit less ego. Maybe it's just everybody just likes to get on with people, have a nice time and get it done. And if there's a problem, we'll tell you, but we're happy to talk, we're happy to do those things. And I think it's quite interesting. It'd be great if less of that politics could come out of other markets as well, or that hesitation, that kind of get it on right, pragmatic kind of approach. I don't know how you feel about that.
I probably have less insight into how those southern markets might operate. Yeah, but certainly I agree with you that, yes, there is a great attitude of let's get on and do this together. And on all of our projects, at the start of it, often I'll take 5 minutes just to say to everybody, the builder included, you know, we're all here to deliver something that's really exciting. We're going to change this little part of the world, and we're going to continue to impact people's lives in this little part of the world for a long time through this building. And so we're all here for the same thing. Let's work out how to deliver it in a really amenable way. We're all here to help solve problems and help deliver something exciting. And that little pep talk at the start of every project can really change people's mentality about shifting it from a sort of politically divided, we're here to, you know, fight about problems, we're here to solve problems together. And often projects that have that attitude, and I've learned that from others that I've seen do that and seen the success in that, and we certainly see the success in that approach in our business as well.
It's starting with the intention in mind and where you're going. I think, Michael, that is a brilliant spot to end. I think that obviously also speaks to how your approach is, and for open architecture, and why you've seen the success you have. And I think we'll continue to see that ahead. So thank you so much for all of your time and your interesting insights as well.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me, Seton.
Thanks. What an absolute pleasure to talk to Michael. We could have kept talking, and there is so many things to go through with him. I think he's one of the leaders out there who really understands what the potential is for AI and how it can help practices, but how it may potentially change the industry. He's running an international organization and he's doing it very well. And I think he's one of those leaders who's going to be showing us what architecture firms can look like in the future.